If you wanna come and count with me, I can show you how. Counting all the things you've done to me, but it's too late now. One.
Hello everyone, and this is episode 52 of Not Another Teen Wolf podcast. We're here recapping Silverfinger, the episode 17 of season 3, which just aired this week. And we have to admit to you, this is our take 2 on this episode. We had a bit of a recording problem the first time we tried to record, and we had to put it off after getting about halfway through and come back today to record. So hopefully we are as vivacious and creative and inventive and clever and psychic and funny, all of those things that you've come to love about us. Hopefully that all still comes through in this episode, even though I'm sure there'll be some particular jokes and points that are now lost to the ether forever because we lost that first original hour of doing this. So cards on the table, that's the situation here. But in order to make up for that, our special guest this week is Jen Smith, the expert on Japan and Tumblr, who has been a big part of our show this season already. She's here because this week was the first official introduction of both the Yakuza and the Kitsune myth. And so she was here, and she was here with us yesterday when we tried to record as well. But in order to sort of bring a bit of unstiltedness to the rehash of the conversation, we've also brought on Donya, who wasn't in the original episode, basically to just guide the conversation in a new direction and not make it sound like we're just trying to remember what we said before, if you know what I mean. So hello, everyone. Hello, Karen.
Hi.
Hello, Jen.
Hi.
Hello, Donya. Hello, me. So, as usual, you can always reach us on our Twitter, email, Tumblr, or on the Hyperball page for the podcast. So Twitter is natwpodcast, email is natwpodcast@gmail.com, and Tumblr is notanotherteenwolfpodcast.tumblr.com. Jen is the same on Twitter and Tumblr, which is P1031. Is that right?
No, 1013.
1013, is it?
Yeah, P1013. It's a hang-on from when I was in the X-Files fandom, so.
Okay, I don't know what that means. I mean, I know what X-Files is, but I don't get the reference, sorry.
1013 was the production company.
Okay.
Who did it, and that's also Agent Mulder's birthday. Okay. And also Carter's birthday.
Okay. So. Interesting. I was going to say that would make a good non sequitur question to explain your screen name, but I guess we've done it now.
Done that already.
Yeah, because my Tumblr handle is super random as well, and I've got a feeling it's super niche and no one understands what it is, but it's fine. And Donya, her Twitter is virtual_Don, and you can also reach her on the podcast accounts as well. So that's us, and we'll crack straight into this episode, Silverfinger, with our favourite quotes. I'm going first in the sweet name of chronology, and because mine comes pretty much directly before Karen's, because my favourite quote was when Scott comes into the school when the twins are stalking him to quote-unquote protect him all day, and, you know, he's trying to lose them, and he says he needs to go talk to Stiles and ask them not to listen in with the wolf hearing, and they were like, how will you even know? And he looks in his locker and has a little smirk, and he goes, I'm a true alpha. You have no idea what I can do. It was hilarious to me that he said this because he clearly also has no idea what he can do. He's completely making this up. He's just using his influence and sort of manipulation as the status of true alpha to get what he wants. I don't think he can hear in on them. I don't think he knows what he can do, but they don't know what he can do, and they believe him because they are so intimidated and needy about him that I just found it super hilarious. I want to see Scott, the true alpha, using his, like, playing his true alpha card to get whatever he wants at all time. Like, oh, I'm a true alpha, so that means you have to do my laundry. And I'm a true alpha, that means you have to do my math homework. Like, just the look on his face when he said it, I just died, and I thought it was a great joke and kind of really really indicative of Scott in general, actually, and his kind of sass. But Karen, did you want to go ahead with yours?
Yeah, mine, like you said, comes right after yours, and this is when Scott actually does go to talk to Stiles, and Stiles tries to explain what's been going on with him, but the key is gone, and the numbers on the chalkboard are gone, and Stiles is trying to explain to him that he thinks something's really wrong with him, and Scott just says, "I don't want to sound like I'm trying to tell you that you're wrong, but I don't think you're trying to kill people either," and this was just such a classy line from Scott, and I loved it because it's the perfect example of a good, solid friendship when you can kind of tell your best friend that you think they're wrong, but not make them feel stupid about it. Mm. And when you have a really solid friendship like that, it's just you can do things, and for that to be portrayed on the show just really means a lot to me because I have a friend, my best friend and I are that close. There's no drama between us. There's no secrets between us. We can just say these things to each other, and I think it's just a really realistic approach to that sort of thing.
It did hit me very hard when that happened, and it was almost such a good line that I wasn't expecting it, if you know what I mean. Like, it was really like, It hit extremely hard. And one thing that I remember also us talking about yesterday was the fact that Stiles just straight up told him. He goes in there, he's like, "I think that I am killing people. I think that this is a problem." And it's one thing that has really impressed me about Teen Wolf is that they are not doing that thing that every other, like, supernatural team drama does, like where there's a group of people and one of them has something going wrong and they don't tell all the others because, mm-hmm. "Oh my God, I can't be a murderer," or like, "Oh my God, they'll hunt me down if they find out," if you know what I mean. Like, that happens, that's the trope. That happens so often. You very rarely be like, as soon as the person finds out, you know, that they're like, "Hey, this is happening. Hey, I might be a demon. Let's do something about it," or whatever. Number one, it just saves time. And it's like, it's like, because we were saying, like, there are so many of these problems that would, like, be, take like a half a season to solve, that would just be like solved immediately if the people just told the other people in their group. And so it sort of escalates this immediately into a bigger actual problem, you know, when there's not the massive problem of them hiding it from everyone. So there's that, and there's also the fact that it just seems so natural that there is that much trust in close friendships, like what Karen mentioned about her friend, and like what happened in Motel California with Allison and Lydia. It's like, something is weird's going on, don't have any proof, but I believe you. Like, it's shows don't usually do that. Like, honestly, and I remember when Motel California came out that I said something similar. There's not that many shows at the moment that have that good portrayal of friendship. Like, they have drama all the time with the friends having drama with each other. There's not that many shows that have portrayals of strong friendships in this way. Maybe a one-on-one situation, maybe brothers, you know, stuff like that, but not a whole group where there is that trust and that it's not, like, drama-based, like, relationship-based or whatever. And it's just very refreshing, and also I find very realistic, because when you are that good friends with people, you know, something weird's happening, you're like, "Dude, what the hell? Help me." Like, you're not like, "Oh my God, I'm going to sit alone and secretly dwell over how I might be a murderer." I mean, some people might, but I just find it really actually weirdly realistic, so.
Yeah, and then going off of the idea of, like, brothers, it seems like the relationship between Scott and Stiles, even though they haven't, I don't feel like they've been spending that much time together so far this season, there's still that closeness between them. Mm. You know, it just because they aren't, you know, sharing the screen together all the time, there's still that, you know, strength.
Yeah.
In their relationship.
Yeah, it's definitely got to the point, I think, with the entire group that they don't, you know, they don't really have, you know, even though there's weird dynamics with some of them, there's no fear at the moment, like, "Oh, something's wrong. you know, someone else in the group might try to kill me, like in the season one, mm-hmm. where like Allison's hunting Scott and Isaac, and you know, they're like, oh, we might have to kill Lydia, she might be a cannibal, like all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I think it really took a turn pretty early on, I think in season two, when Scott and Stiles, well, Scott specifically, I think Stiles was more up for it, was like, no, we're not going to kill Jackson, even though we know he's killing people. I think that was a real turning point in the whole, yeah, we're not going to do that on this show. So yeah. I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, they have good communication. You don't see that a lot.
That's what I was going to say. The communication between the characters is really improved as well. So where they may have been hiding more stuff, maybe not Scott and Stiles necessarily from each other, yeah. but from, like, the other characters, yeah. the communication between, like, the ensemble cast has been so much better this season.
Yeah, yeah.
And you've seen the improvements in their relationships because of that. And that's been really interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. So my favorite quote from the episode is probably not as deep as the other two. But it is just as glorious because it's from the scene where they're fighting the Oni, and or I guess it's right after they fight the Oni, and Ethan and Aiden are standing by the door with Kira. Aiden tries to figure out what she is, and Derek just comes up and says, "She's a kitsune, idiot." And it just, I love Derek when he's sassy, and I love it when he's kind of a jerk, and it was perfect and wonderful, and he's such a book nerd, and I adore him.
He was so smug about it. It was like, it's so like, yeah, as you know, it seems to fit with this idea of Derek slowly emerging, that like he is a nerd, or at least he's very well educated or researched or something. In you know, there have been these implications that he speaks all these languages, he always knows about all these different mythological creatures or legends or procedures, like, oh, I've heard about that, in a way that, you know, on one hand you could be like, oh, is it because he's like a born werewolf? Maybe they grow up doing special werewolf classes or something. But then, like, the other born werewolves, not that we've seen many, but like Peter and Cora, that kind of stuff never really seems to come up with them, and it's always Derek being the instructional video into the supernatural world or whatever. And yeah, how much does he know? Like, has he spent his time, like, when he was away from Beacon Hills? Like I said in another episode, like, has he got like 87 college degrees? Like, I don't understand. But yeah, I like this sort of emerging tough guy nerd who keeps his geeky passions secret, and I feel like him and Kira should probably have a bonding session over like their weird mythology nerdness.
I can't like not picture him doing these instructional videos now, like putting out these DVD sets of like, today we're going to learn about, you know, the Kanama and
Tears.
And
sorry. sorry. I'm very sorry.
Oh, like mental floss for mythology.
Yeah, yeah. Totally. There's the episode title right there, by the way. And then Donya, you had to be depressing. So
of course I did. I chose thanks, Mom, line from Stiles, because that whole scene just got me. Now, I slept through the episode where I usually watch it live with everyone else.
Yep.
I actually slept through it this time because my alarm didn't go off. So I decided, oh, I'll just watch it over breakfast because I'm on a late shift at work, so I've got time. Yeah, crying into my cornflakes is not a good way to start my day. whole scene wrecked me. Just the emotion behind it. I mean, I'm a big sucker for the family relationships, and that's like between the parents and, you know, their biological children. But this was really, really touching in that she was caring for Stiles and mothering him as well a little bit. And that really got me, because you're starting to see a lot more crossover between the parents protecting the other kids of the show as well. Yeah. especially now since the sheriff has come into the know as well.
Yeah.
So I think it was a really, really interesting sort of duo, because up until this point, most of the scenes between Melissa and Styles have been really comedic.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the one where he climbs in through the window and she's got the bat.
Yeah.
And the one after, is it after Styles has the key cut?
Mm. I got a key, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That whole scene is hilarious. Well, thinking about that one.
With the thanks, Mum line, I mean, obviously that the entire scene and what's going on with Styles is something that we'll talk quite a lot about when we get to it in the recap. But the thanks, Mum line in particular, Donya, do you think was a product of his sort of illness / delusion / sedative, like in the situation he was kind of picturing his own mother, or like that it just came out? Or do you think it was that he kind of mentally does put Melissa into that role and sort of mentally thinks that way about her and then it accidentally came out? Like, do you think he was thinking about Melissa or like mistaking her for his own mother in that situation?
I think it might have been a mix of the two, because I get the feeling that what Melissa was doing was something that his own mother may have done with him. And with, obviously, the sedative, it probably kind of triggered that. So her mothering instinct probably just reminded him so strongly of his mum. But I don't know, I get the feeling that he probably feels quite strongly about Melissa. She's been, like, the one strong female influence in his life, which I guess we can kind of assume from Styles and Scott's close friendship that they probably spent quite a lot of time together over each other's houses, especially after his mother died. So, you know, he's probably in a way latched onto that a little bit.
Yeah.
So I get the feeling it's got a lot of crossover, that it's a little bit because he's almost maybe in the back of his mind more than anything, sees her in that way.
Yeah.
But the sedative and her actions with him probably brought it to the forefront.
Yeah. Well, more on that entire situation. More on that situation soon, because we super depressed ourselves over some options that we will be discussing momentarily. But yeah. Karen, do you want to go straight into taking us through what we saw in this episode?
Yeah, definitely. Let's talk about something superficial now, guys.
Because yeah.
We have to see young Chris, played by Max Lloyd Jones. Oh. And I think the general consensus is he's a little bit of a hottie.
Yeah.
He's a little bit's probably an understatement.
He's so hot. He's like, I remember when Teen Wolf first came out, well, not when it first came out, when I first watched Teen Wolf and people were like, all the different people they fancy, mine was always Jackson. Like, he's a bit, he was a bit perfect, but looks-wise, he's my thing. And I actually don't usually like, super pretty white boys. Like, usually I like kind of dirty-looking, grungy, kind of, like, dark-skinned or, like, long-haired boys. But Jackson, I don't know, I just liked him a lot, and this guy is even better. This is, like, my favorite, looks-wise, my favorite guy that's ever been on Teen Wolf, because he was, like, kind of scruffy in the way that Chris Argent is as an adult, like, but he has, like, that nice tawny hair and eyes, and he looks all, like, charming, and I really liked him, guys. I hope to see him again, because I really liked him.
His eyes, though. Yeah. Oh, yes, my God. They managed to find someone with eyes that are almost as blue as JR's, because having met JR in real life, his eyes are really that blue.
Yeah.
So finding someone like younger who has almost identical eyes, kudos casting department. That was a really good find.
he's a nice boy. I enjoyed his presence in the show. And usually I'm not the one being like, hot boys in Teen Wolf. Usually I don't even care. But not that they're not all good looking, but like usually I'm just like, it's not what I'm here for. But oh, this guy was so cute.
But basically, Chris is, young Chris is 18 and he's in Japan. And this, the reason why he's in the show, other than for us to ogle at him, was because this is the first time he actually came up against the Masked Warriors. And they were after a supernatural creature that he didn't recognize. Like, to this day, he still doesn't really know what it is. And we'll find out later what it is. But this sort of like sets up the scene for us. But the one main thing that I really wanted to bring up was that I mean, I already want to punch Gerard every time he's on screen, but it's kind of insane how he would send his son into this situation where he didn't know it was the Yakuza that he was going up against, and he wanted to know if he could survive and adapt. And it's like, who does that to their kid?
Yeah, a jerk face, McJerk. I don't know, like, a couple of things that are interesting is that he was doing a simple gun deal, his first gun deal, and it was meant to be in Japan, and he didn't know it was Yakuza, so it was meant to be with normal Japanese non-mafia people, I guess.
Which now makes no sense to me, because people in Japan, like, they don't have guns.
Yeah.
Like, they don't do the guns.
I mean, unless it was meant to be, like, hunters that weren't Yakuza. Like, I don't know, maybe he thought it was going to be hunters instead of Yakuza. But if it was just, do you think that the Argents have always had a cover, they actually do business as, like, gun tradespeople as opposed to hunters, like, on the surface? Or was it part of the hunting job, if you know what I mean? Like, I'm a bit confused as to who he thought he was doing this deal with. Like, it's a bit weird. But Gerard, I don't know, man. I just can't with him. And I still really want to find out about the mother and, you know, why she let her husband do this to his son. And if she had an affair with the mailman or something, and Chris isn't really, you know, her son, you know, had an affair with Frank Sinatra or someone with crazy blue eyes. Like, and that, you know, Gerard resents that, and that's why he's always, like, tortured the hell out of Chris, or whether Gerard just thinks that's the right way to treat people. I don't know.
I wouldn't be surprised if it was the latter, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, no.
Yeah.
Giant, giant jerk.
Yeah, to say the least.
Where is he still just moldering away in that nursing home?
I hope he choked on his black spit and died sometime between A and B, because there's no need for him.
Yeah. I think we're meant to assume that he's probably still there, but they haven't really established whether he is or not.
Yeah, no, definitely haven't seen him. Hope we never do.
much as I love Michael Hogan, I really don't like Gerard.
He scares me, like, just in general. Hogan? He's so intimidating.
Like, the actor or the character?
Yeah, the actor. Like, I mean, I've seen a little bit of Battlestar Galactica, and he was on there too, obviously. And he just, I don't know, if I ever, like, met him in person, I would probably run away. He just scares me.
Yeah. They're trying to get him to PopCon.
This is the funniest thing. He is the sweetest guy in person. Like, he is so lovely. He's so nice, because I met him at the London Film and Comic Con.
Favorite person in the world.
But I met him at the London Film and Comic Con when I used to still, like, do... I used to do costuming and stuff, and I used to go quite regularly. And I have a friend, like, one of my best friends from university, who is the biggest Battlestar Galactica fan you will ever meet. And the two separate times I went there that they had Battlestar Galactica guests was when they had Edward James Olmos there, and they had Michael Hogan there. Like, they have one in May, and they have one in, I think it's October. And I met them both at the separate ones, but I'd never bought, like, a print and went specifically to get it signed. I ran into them as I was changing between costumes. So I was heading to, like, the toilets to go and get it, but they had, like, they had their people with them, and I was like, oh, hey, my friend is a massive fan of you, can I get you to record, like, a really quick message just to say hi to him? And they were carrying the excess prints with them that they hadn't, like, gotten rid of, and he was like, oh, well, let me make one out to your friend. You can take it with you and give that to him as
well. You don't have to pay $40 to buy this. Here you go. Basically, just have it.
They were selling them. Like, they were really expensive because you had to buy the print and then you had to buy your ticket to go in the line to have it signed.
Yeah, it's insane. But yeah.
It was crazy. Yeah. But, I ended up walking away. And that was the same with Michael Hogan and Edward James Olmos. I ended up walking away with two prints that he still has because I saw him the other day. My friend still has on the mantelpiece in his new house.
Oh, that's nice. Let's know, did this happen before he was Gerard?
Yes, way so before.
It'll be different now. You'll meet him and he'll be evil. Like, it will be different.
Totally probably. Possible.
Like, that's how it works, right? Like,
Yeah,
of course. Take well, yeah. But we have, the other character that was prominent in this scene was Katashi, Silverfinger, and he's one of the only other ones that survived, and this is actually who Chris has been looking for all night, but he obviously didn't want to be found, because that's why Chris came home all bloody and beaten up and stuff like that. But the big thing in this scene to me was just the willingness of Chris to work with Isaac and Scott, considering that they're werewolves, and it's just such a different change in character than what we've seen. He's been really reluctant before, and it wasn't even an issue, and I really like this new direction that he's going in.
Yeah, I mean, just to have him turn around and kind of say, you know, Allison being like, oh, it seems like they were coming after Scott, and Chris is like, well, we got to figure out how we're going to protect him then, like, duh, like, that's what we're gonna do, right? And it's like, yeah, I mean, it's just, it doesn't seem like it's hard for him. It doesn't seem like he's battling with himself or anything like that. It seems like that's what I do now. This is like, I am on the side of good, whether they are, I know about the supernatural, and I'm on the side of good, whether the good is a werewolf or a person or whatever. And it seems so much more comfortable for him than being a straight up and down hunter in the way that he was, like, when the whole Argent family hunter code thing was going on. He was the one always trying to be like, code, when everyone was like, yeah, nah. And and it just seems like he was never really comfortable doing what he did as a hunter. It was just sort of what he was trained to do and the part he had to play. And now this seems to just, it's like he's sitting there going, yeah, like, this is right. We're doing what's right now. And I can't believe it took his, like, 16-year-old daughter to, like, teach him that, and that he didn't have enough spine to, like, break out and do that on his own. But I guess it's good that he's better now or something.
It's almost been freeing, I think, yeah, the new code for him.
Yeah.
It's kind of, and I also think, turning that on its head, I also think that's a really nice message to show that it doesn't matter your age, you can still teach someone something.
Yeah, and you can still change.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no matter how old you are.
Yeah.
You know, there's still things you can learn, still ways that the world can either change you or even now you can change the world, because this new code with them is going to really, really impact, I think, the way that Beacon Hills works as well, because there's a lot less tension and friction. They're all starting to come together as an actual team, and I think that's gonna save more people when, you know,
yeah,
everything starts to go down.
Directly after this scene, we get the one where Scott brings Kira back to her house. And basically, she's talking to him about how, like, oh, so everybody's kind of a werewolf, huh? And Scott's just like, yeah. And she asks to see his werewolf face, and he shows her. He's a little hesitant, but she's totally cool with it, which I don't think any of us were surprised about. But did you guys like that part?
She's more than cool with it. She's, like, ecstatic. She's like, this is so freaking cool. Like, the way that she kind of reaches up and touches his face, and then when she's lying on her bed, like, grinning and remembering, it's not even just like, it's not like, oh, a boy likes me, like, because they haven't, like, kissed yet or whatever. Like, they know that they kind of like each other, but, like, it wasn't that. She was, like, reminiscing about the fact that he's a werewolf and looking, like, blissed out about it. And it's, like, amazing, because I just, like, she's, they haven't outright said this, but that no one is going to, like, dig this headcanon out away from me. I'm going to, like, clutch it in my arms until I die. That she is, like, a super goth, like, nerd, like, you know, fandom, you know, mythology, into kind of the supernatural in terms of, like, TV and books and all that kind of stuff. And she's just been, like, presented with, oh my god, this is real, and oh my god, I get to date a werewolf. I was Team Jacob, and now I get to date a werewolf, kind of thing. and she just looks so stoked on it. So yeah, that was hilarious to me that she's so into it. And I wonder if they're gonna actually say anything. Like, that there's gonna be a funny scene where, like, Styles comes over to her house and discovers, like, her wall of, like, different, like, you know, like, vampire diaries and, like, supernatural merch and stuff. But the other thing was, like, yeah, you guys loved the special effects, a cop-out of him putting on the helmet and then taking off, so they didn't have to do digital special effects. They could just do, like, the nothing and then the prosthetic makeup. A bit of a budget saver there. Do you like how that was done?
Yes, I really did, because, I mean, there's nothing worse than bad CGI, and I think for, you know, us, when we pick apart the episode and stuff, it's really obvious that that's why they're doing it, but I think, like, for a regular viewer, it's kind of subtle enough that they're not like, oh, you know, yeah, they're just doing that to save money, but I really am impressed all the time. We've talked about this before, about the ways in which they can kind of get around that stuff, and they keep doing it in different ways. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, as long as it keeps being pretty natural, like I think this one was, then I'm totally fine with it.
Yeah.
And I think for me, honestly, part of what I love about Teen Wolf is the terrible CGI. So while I'm happy that they found a way to save money and not look awful, I kind of miss, like the opening episode of 3A where the twins are running. And it's like, yeah, you're clearly running in place in front of a green screen right now. Like, I kind of love that about the show.
I do not. I either don't notice when something is bad, or I notice and it grosses me out. Like, I'm really, but honestly, I often don't notice, in the sense of, like, people, I'll be watching, like, a movie or something, people, oh, that was so badly done, and I'm like, what? I don't even know what you're talking about. So, like, I'm like, wow, computers make things move. Like, it's not hard to impress me. I mean, except in Mortal Kombat, which we'll talk about a little bit. We'll touch on that when we get to meeting Mr. Katashi later in the episode. But
the other thing that kind of threw me off about this scene was that Kira's been out of the house for like 24 hours at this point, and she was just almost murdered. Like,
yeah,
legitimately was taken kidnapped by a mass murderer.
Yeah,
and she was my kid. She would not be going to a rave and hanging out with a boy and coming home at 6 o'clock in the morning.
She definitely, like, snuck in, so I feel like they don't know that she was.
Well, but that's what I'm saying, is I would, like,
be like, where are you? Why are you not at home? Like,
exactly. Yeah. I would have noticed.
Yeah, funnily, kid. Yeah, when your child almost gets murdered.
You just care a bit about where they are.
Yeah.
Good point. But speaking of Kira, I've been noticing a lot of parallels between her relationship with Scott and Allison's relationship with Scott, and the different, like, you know, they both sort of mommed him at one point, and the way that they looked at his werewolf face and sort of touched it and that sort of thing. I'm seeing a lot of parallels there, and part of me really likes it, because I'm like, they're showing that you can fall in love with somebody else, that this person is a different person, but you can have the same kind of love with them. But at the same time, I don't want them to go too far with it, because I don't want her to become an Allison replacement, because I really like Kira for Kira, and I want their relationship, if they do end up having a relationship, to be very different to the one between Scott and Allison.
Yeah, and I think the parallels, especially when it comes to them touching Scott's face when he's a werewolf, when it's that first reveal, the emotion behind the characters is so,
there's such a big contrast between it.
Yeah, yeah, because Allison was...
Right.
Yeah, so, yeah, Allison was kind of, like, not horrified, but kind of, like, well, she was a bit horrified, but she was kind of, like, I'm sucking this up, I'm accepting it, this is, I love you anyway, like, was very much, I love you anyway, but...
Yeah, and Kira's, like, she's at
Disney. Yes! Yes! Like, score! Like, yeah. So I definitely noticed that as well. I noticed that, like, I thought it was meant to be a direct kind of comparison of immediate acceptance. And, yeah, even though, you know, obviously Allison kind of already knew about werewolves. She didn't know Scott was one, whereas Kira's all just discovering this and Allison had, like, a negative bias. But, yeah, I definitely saw that. That as a kind of parallel in terms of acceptance or whatever.
Kira's reaction was just missing little sparkles, like, going everywhere.
Anime sparkles, yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. That was kind of the feeling I got.
So what did you guys think about the twins electing themselves to be Scott's 24-hour guardians against the demonic ninjas, as they're calling them?
I enjoyed them being like, you know, Ethan being very practical and being like, well, seeing as we have no previous experience with demonic ninjas, I think we're going to play it safe. I mean, that's one of the more sensible things anyone's ever said on the show. but... I mean, I thought it was fairly warranted, like, in terms of if he wants to, you know, if they're worried about what's going on and they are, I mean, it does vibe a bit of, like, they're not actually caring about protecting Scott because they love Scott as a human. They are caring about protecting Scott because they want sort of something in return. It still kind of smacks of that a bit, but...
I think Aiden wants something in return. I think Ethan is doing it more because he wants to help keep Scott safe.
Yeah. The twins, yeah, we keep tossing up and down about this with the twins. But it's, yeah, I mean, it's certainly getting to a point where they are trying to throw it all in for Scott, regardless of why. And, you know, Scott's not too into that, and I don't know whether it's just, like, he doesn't want help or he doesn't want help from them or what. Like, why do you think he's so, like, leave me alone to them? Does he really still, like not approve of them, or does he think they're being pathetic or, like...
I mean, they killed Boyd. Yeah. It's an unavoidable fact. I mean, it's not something that they're going to brush under the carpet immediately. You know, so yeah. I can understand him being standoffish and not really trying to accept their help.
I mean, he let them help, like, search the school and stuff, so I don't know where we're at the moment.
I think it's almost, very tentative allies.
Yeah.
But not in the way that they, well, I guess not in the way that Scott really trusts them.
Right.
Just that they potentially have slightly more knowledge about being an alpha and what is actually out there. So they could, you know, unintentionally give him more knowledge for what he needs to be able to protect people.
Right.
But again, you've still got that shadow of, like, what they did to Boyd and, like, hanging over them that, you know, they're probably never going to be fully trusted because of that. Because the way that they're, like, reacting and the way that they're kind of playing into this whole we want to be part of your pack thing, it's they're trying to get something out of it. And unless it reminds me so much of Peter, unless there's something in it for them, it doesn't feel genuine.
Yeah.
And that I kind of put them a little bit on the same level as Peter.
Yeah.
For me, in terms of their motives. So... yeah, that's how I'm feeling about the twins.
Fair enough. So in the next scene, we basically talked about this a little bit already, but this is where Stiles goes to show Scott what he learned that morning after the party, because this is, you know, directly after the party. It's November 1st. And so the numbers are gone from the chalkboard. The key is missing. Styles doesn't know what's going on, but he pulls out this piece of paper that says something that Barrow did, the shrapnel bomber. He put in like all of these nails and screws and stuff, and he put the bomb inside of it and wrapped it up like a Christmas present or a birthday present. And it was basically exactly what Styles did to Coach when he played that joke on him on Mischief Night.
Minus the bomb, of course.
Minus the bomb, yeah. So Styles is freaking out right now, and I don't think anybody can really blame him.
Yeah, I mean, with the shrapnel bomber, are we thinking that we're talking, and the joke, are we thinking that, like, he was influenced to do that by whatever influenced Barrow to do that as well, or are we thinking that this thing with Styles predates what we've seen, if you know what I mean, whether he was the influence behind the shrapnel bomb as well, however long ago that was?
I literally just had this thought, but we don't, and correct me if I'm wrong, do we ever see what's on the paper?
No, I was like, why does he, I actually have that. I'm like, what does he scrunch up in his hand? Like, why does he scrunch it up in his hand? Like,
so what if what he thinks he's reading isn't there? Like, what if this detail of the shrapnel bomber case isn't actually a detail of what happened there? It's just part of whatever Styles is going through, where he thinks he's reading stuff.
Because did Scott really see what was on the paper? Did he look at it?
I don't know.
No, because I don't recall him getting a chance to actually properly look at it.
Look
because
at
Styles
it.
Started connecting. Like, that whole scene, Styles was, like, three steps ahead of Scott's mm-hmm. reactions mm-hmm. to anything. Mm. So by the time Scott even had a chance to process what Styles was actually saying, Styles had already moved on. Mm. So I'm pretty sure he'd already scrunched the paper up before Scott had even had a chance to try and verify what was on it and what Styles was saying was accurate.
Mm.
Yeah, that's definitely a good question and something that I think we're going to have to keep our eyes out for going forward. Like, because, you know, Scott didn't see the key, maybe he didn't see the paper. Like, we'll have to keep an eye out if what Styles is actually imagining versus, you know, what could actually be real. So that's kind of interesting.
Like, I mean, because we, at this point, Caitlin saw the key. Like, he definitely had the key.
Yeah.
And Lydia saw the writing on the board. Like, you know, she was there for that. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit confusing.
Was Styles wearing the white shirt with the blue edging in both of those scenes?
In this scene where he was talking to Scott?
No, when he was talking with Caitlin at the party with the key.
No.
And when he was talking with Lydia at the chalkboard.
With the chalkboard, it flashed in and out, I think.
No, yeah, when he was in the chemistry room, it flashed in and out.
Right, and when he was talking to Caitlin, it wasn't that shirt. I've been keeping my eye out for that man. I'm like, you're not going to slide by me again.
Such a tough guy, Karen. You're going to get them. But, yeah, I don't know. Anyway.
Yeah, it's to think about. But, you know, moving on from that, we get actually one of my favorite scenes. I just really love this scene. Basically, Chris decides to draw Katashi out by saying he's going to sell an antique gun that he has. And he is hoping Katashi is going to be the one to do the deal, but it doesn't end up being that way. He's kind of got his own people that will be there to hand the money over and that sort of thing. So Chris must go to his plan B, and his plan B involves Isaac in a suit. And basically, Isaac is super worried that he's not going to be able to pull this off. And we get Allison, you know, turning him from a boy to a man with a little bit of kissing and groping. So what did you guys think about that?
super awful.
Why is every scene with this couple the worst scene ever? Every scene, every episode, something escalates to being the most awkward thing that's ever happened. I thought there could never be anything more awkward on this show than, like, Scott's awkward dinners at the Argent family home when, like, Gerard and Kate and stuff were still there. But no, this is just crazy town, awkward city, and I can't handle it. It's like, who does that? Like, I just, like, the kissing I get, and I even get kind of why she did the butt groping in terms of, like, ooh, I'm going to make him sexually charged. Like, I'm going to rev him up, and then he's going to be all like, yeah, I groped a butt. I'm going to walk in there like I own the world. But who does that? It's very shameless. And I mean, good for her for being shameless about sex and her body. But, like, I just, made me feel so awkward. And,
and her dad's on the other side of that, the car. That was private. Her dad is right there.
Like, I was expecting the kiss. I was like, the kiss is, like, super tropey and, like, oh, yeah, I'm going to blow your mind with a kiss. The butt grope, her hand making him grope the butt is not tropey. Good for Teen Wolf for taking it in their own direction. But, I mean, it's not the first time we've seen Allison sort of do this either. If you look, like, at Scott with the bowling and the picture me naked. So this is clearly just what works for Allison, I guess. And it's like, it's just so weird. I mean, it's cool, but, like, it just makes me feel so awkward. I don't know. But it works for Isaac, I guess.
I love it, though, because I feel like this was their first kiss, obviously, the one between Allison and Isaac. And so I feel like it couldn't have happened in any other way. Like, if it had been really genuine or something, it would have, like, come off strange.
Something to me. Yeah, I mean, it might mean something to them. But, like, but yeah, if it hadn't been one of their beautiful, awkward scenarios, I'm just worried about how that, like, those weird, awkward sex scenes are going to escalate. Like, I'm just...
Yeah, going forward into the rest of the season.
Yeah, I'm just... Well, it is going to be like that. Like, it's going to get worse and worse until, like, I don't even know what's going to happen, but I'm worried. So...
Yeah.
I have a feeling she's going to use that, like, study technique where you're like, every time you get an answer right, I'll take off a piece of clothing. But, like, they're going to be... They're going to be in, like, study group. Like, it's going to be everybody at the
school. Like, he's going to be trying to do, like, a presentation in class. Yeah, and she's going to be at the back, like, taking off, like, clothes. Like, no.
But wasn't it great when he walked through the doors and he, like, takes off his aviators and was like, I believe Mr. Kitashi is expecting me. He just looked so smug and proud of himself.
I liked when he was, like, all nervous and his accent went all funny. I don't know. It was a great scene. When he's like, we'll have to go to my plan B. How tall are you? And then his reaction when he wears the suit. It is fantastic. Like, I freaking love Daniel Sharman. He's been gold. I can't believe how much I used to not dislike him, but I can't believe how much I hated Isaac at the start. He's perfect. But it's, that happened, I guess. And then he goes in and they do the chat until later. Apparently no one's, like, at school today. Because, like, Allison and Isaac just didn't go to school. And, like, that was fine. And no one, like, commented on that. And then Styles takes himself out of school, right?
Isn't it the weekend?
Yeah. No, because Scott and the twins are at school.
Well, I can understand why Styles didn't go, because he went to the hospital instead.
Yeah.
And then I guess Allison could have been called in sick by Chris, and nobody cares about Isaac.
No one cares what Isaac does.
Maybe that's where Lydia was. Lydia was the only one that actually went to classes.
Yeah, true.
Kira, because she's a nerd.
Yeah.
Kira's going to be sleeping it off. She's been awake for, like, 3 days.
I thought that as well. I mean, we're about to get the scene where basically Styles goes into the hospital in order to, you know, he kind of checks himself in. He wants to see the doctor, and Melissa kind of helps him out, and we'll talk about that in much more detail. But, like, basically the situation there is that they are all, like, that he is really sleep deprived, and he says he's got like 8 hours sleep in the last 3 days or whatever. All the others have been up all night as well. Like, yeah, exactly. like minimize Styles' problems, but they've all been doing the same thing for the last 3 days. So like, you know, and Allison still looks fresh as a frickin' daisy. Like, you know, and she's not a supernatural being. So I don't know. I mean, something's clearly taking its toll on Styles, but like, it just was interesting to me that they've pretty much all been out for like, you know, 3 days in a row solving these kind of dramas, and I don't know how much sleep they've got. They've all got
Red Bull.
Probably, yeah, probably not a lot. But yeah, getting into the scene where Styles checks himself into the hospital, one of the things I really like about Teen Wolf is that we can go from a scene where, you know, we get that Allison and Isaac kiss, which is so awkward, and, you know, just Isaac being awkward with the guys he's trying to sell the gun to, and then you go into a scene that is the complete opposite of that, and Styles is practically crying. He's really scared. He checks himself into the hospital. Melissa is obviously terrified for him. And, you know, they do that switch between the tones so well that I think that, I mean, it's a good juxtaposition because it shows you how light and funny it, you know, one situation is and then how dark the other one is. Mm. But it's also hard to transition between those two. And I think they do it so well.
They pretty much handle every genre very well, I feel like. And it never feels particularly unnatural. Like, oh, that's not what the show is, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. But we find out a lot of what Styles is suffering from in this scene. And, I mean, we already knew a lot of it, but, you know, he has blackouts, sleepwalking, anxiety and panic attacks, insomnia. He's irritable. He has an inability to focus, impulsiveness, vivid dreams during the day. And basically, Melissa was like, okay, I know exactly what's wrong with you. You're not getting enough sleep. And she jabs him with some sedative, and which you can't do, by the way.
I was like that as well. She was like, do you trust me? And he was like, not when you're holding a needle. And, you know, she goes, it's mesapaline or whatever it was, and then jabs him with it before she tells him it's a sedative. That's definitely
not. And she's also not a doctor. She can't technically prescribe medication of any sort.
Yeah,
so exactly. Like my mom.
I have a feeling he's not even properly checked in. I feel like she just took him to the room.
Well, she had an intake form. She was filling out like something you fill in when you're in a doctor's office. But yeah, she kind of jumped the gun a little bit. I think.
Oh, but it's okay. We'll suspend disbelief because it was a really beautiful scene.
Yeah.
But basically, yeah, we get the thanks, Mom, which we've talked about, and it's, you know, incredible and everything, and I really did enjoy it. But I think the part that really blew me away even more is when she compares his charts to Claudia's charts, his mom, and we find out that they're suffering from a lot of the same things, and obviously Claudia has died. And Danya, you're actually the one that came to us with this really cool, I mean, not cool, it's horrible. It's not cool at all.
But it's terrible.
It's a very good theory as to what Claudia might have had. So do you want to explain that to us?
Yes. Yeah, so basically, the reason I started, like, thinking about this originally is because, like, my grandmother had Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. So I went through a very, very long stage. Like, my coping mechanism right at the start was I researched. But I researched pretty much anything that had to do with, like, that had a link into dementia. Mm. And one of the things I found was this disease called fatal familial insomnia. And I mean, it had absolutely nothing to do with what my gran was going through. It was, you know, when you're in Wikipedia and you're like clicking links.
Yeah, you go down the Wikipedia trap. You go from page to page, and then you just end up in.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's been a long time since I'd read that page, but it was sort of in the back of my head. So when I was watching the episode over breakfast, I was like, hold on a second, all of these symptoms, I'm pretty sure I remember reading something about that. So I kind of started going back and going, what was it called? So I'm back to the first place or remembered seeing it, and I started going through the dementia pages again and looking and going through it all. But basically, the disease itself is contained within families. So it usually will kind of come out when you're in your middle age. So it doesn't tend to present itself when you're younger. If it does, it's very, very rare. But the disease itself can only be passed down from parent to child. There is no other way to pass it on. So essentially, you basically run through exactly the same symptoms that Styles is suffering from. So there's four stages that take between 7 to 18 months to run through. So as soon as it kind of presents itself in someone, you start in stage one getting insomnia, panic attacks, paranoia, extreme phobias, which lasts for a few months, that then moves on to hallucinations, the panic attacks becoming more noticeable, so more extreme panic attacks. Complete inability to sleep is then followed by like rapid loss of weight. So obviously without being able to get enough sleep, the brain starts to sort of shut down. It can't sort of almost regenerate itself, so it's not resting at all. So mm-hmm. that's where the sort of major deterioration starts coming in. And then the final stage is dementia, during which the patient becomes unresponsive or mute. And then after that point, it's death. It's not curable.
I was going to say, yeah, we were reading through this yesterday, and literally 100% fatality. Like, they have never found a way to even help this. And they, you know, treated some people with sedatives or even medical comas, but it still didn't work. Like, the body was sleeping, but the brain wasn't actually off in the way it is when you sleep. And there is literally no cure, and the only thing people can do is make people comfortable while they go through it, basically. And yeah, one of the worst things I've ever heard of, really.
Yeah. So the one thing that stood out to me, because I didn't know I was coming on the episode today. So on my own, like right after the episode, after I'd gone back through this, there's a documentary on YouTube about this. It's really, really fascinating. It's super fascinating. It's two children of a family that actually has this disease. Like their grandfather, their uncle, and then their mother all died of it. There is a huge chance that, you know, the age that they are, they're coming up to about the age where it would start presenting itself. But they also have children. There's no way to know whether you have it or not. There's no way.
I mean, it's just such an interesting thing that's like such a tiny like niche disease, like that it's only sort of found in about 40 like gene pools, like 40 families, and it seems to fit this pretty exactly. It would be a bit strange that no one has brought this up with Styles, you know, before, that he could put, you know, potentially be prone to this if this is what it is indeed. But I do think that, you know, I've thought for a while that whatever was up with Claudia, basically since we started hearing stuff about, I think since 3A, since we started kind of wondering about what was going on with Styles and mentality, I have been suspecting that like Claudia's death was not like, oh, cancer, like in 500 billion fan fiction, you know, so sad, you know, but, you know, not a brain thing. I have been thinking for a long time that was a degenerative brain disease. And when Melissa was reading out those symptoms, I was like, that sounds like mad cow disease. And this thing is actually fairly similar to that in it causes a prion, which I don't know what that is, but it's something in the brain. It causes a prion protein, which is the same thing that mad cow disease does, basically. So I was like, at least I'm not totally off on my medical knowledge. Not that I am in any way a medical professional. I just had a feeling it's a similar problem a specific problem with similar symptoms caused by the same kind of thing.
Yeah, and a prion is a type of protein that it seems to have like a more primitive structure.
Yeah.
And it can self-replicate. Oh, so it causes all sorts of problems when it gets into your brain. With mad cow disease, which I'm half remembering the technical name for it. It turns your
brain into a bovine spongiform encephalitis.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It turns your brain to a sponge, and this does something to the brain too.
The
interesting thing to note with this one, which is something I learned from the documentary, I don't remember reading this on the Wikipedia page, is that with dementia and Alzheimer's, you kind of, your quality of life becomes so bad that you're not aware of what's happening to you.
Yeah.
So you're not aware of like how badly you're degenerating. But with this disease, you're aware of everything that's happening to you up until the point where you die.
Oh, good.
You know that you're deteriorating and you're basically losing basic human functions, and you're aware of every second of it. Cool. And that was the bit that kind of threw me in the documentary, and I was like floods of tears, just like, oh my god, because I couldn't yeah. imagine being aware of that through every stage.
Yeah. If I got diagnosed with this, I would just there. We have a shotgun, and it would not be appropriately.
Yeah,
no, I would. That's not okay. That's just not okay.
I don't think I'm going to be watching this documentary, Donya. But basically, you know, it's meant to come on in middle age, but it can come on as young as 18. And I mean, we don't know if this is specifically what Stiles has. It seems to fit extremely well, and it seems to fit, you know, Claudia. And it's, you know, interesting if Jeff was kind of looking for these degenerative diseases and came across this and thought, yeah, this is the one I'm going to use. But now we have some questions about whether the brain disease, whatever it is that's wrong with Stiles, whether it's this or something else,
mm-hmm.
whether it's real, whether it's, you know, whether it is actually a brain disease, a medical non-supernatural thing, whether it is a supernatural problem which people are going to diagnose as a brain disease because of his mother having something, whether his mother actually had something as well, like we find out that, you know, about the no Gitsune, and whether that was something to do, you know, whether she was a part of that as well, or, you know, whether this is a genuine problem, which is sort of, you know, the supernatural stuff is exacerbated, or that even he was preyed upon because his brain is already damaged naturally. So there's a few options here about what it could be. But if it is this fatal familial insomnia and it's actually a real problem, or even if it's the supernatural element, but it becomes an incurable problem. We were kind of talking yesterday, so this is going to get less of a good reaction now, but what if the only, you know, is this something that, like, the bite would heal? Like, as a like a werewolf bite, if Scott turned him? If the option was, like, he's in a coma, he might die from this fatal familial insomnia, or he might die from getting turned into a werewolf, but maybe he'll get turned into a werewolf and get completely healed. Because we haven't seen, obviously, Scott address having to turn anyone. He's an alpha now. He has that power. I feel like it's something that will be explored at some point. You know, it's going to be a very different thing for Scott turning people rather than Derek just, like, collecting teenagers. And, oh, God, those were some bad life choices. And I just thinking back, like, who does that? Man, Derek sucked as an alpha. But, yeah, like, what do you think could happen there? Like,
in terms of if Scott would actually turn him and, well, like, that sort of thing?
Well, yeah, I mean, both whether it would be, you know, you'd be okay with him becoming a werewolf. Like, you know, people have talked for a long time about not wanting that, about whether he'd rather become a werewolf than die. Do you think Stiles would rather that, like, how much he values life, or whether what's happening to him is real or supernatural and all of that, those kind of things?
I mean, it's hard because I've always been, you know, a huge proponent for Stiles staying human. I think that's really important for the show. But at the same time, if it comes down between Styles dying or Styles turning into a werewolf, like, give me the werewolf, obviously. So, and I think, like, it would be a really interesting plot point going forward, you know, with Scott having to deal with the guilt of, you know, maybe taking that choice out of Styles' hand if he is, you know, in a coma or something like that. And also if there's going to be any resentment from Styles towards Scott for taking that choice out of his hands. So it would be interesting to see them deal with that together. But, I mean, I don't know. This whole situation is just really stressful.
I mean, do you think Styles is really sick, or do you think that what has happened to him is the product of the Nogitsune, which we will learn more about later in this episode?
The thoughts that I kind of had on this kind of went either one of two ways, was that if Claudia actually had this disease, it's possible that Styles has inherited it from her. That is the Nogitsune kind of displaying the symptoms to kind of mask that.
That's exactly what I said yesterday, Donya. That's literally what I said yesterday. I was like, is the Nogitsune purposely picking people whose behavior could be covered up by something else?
That's
what I thought.
That's the one way I was thinking. But then the other way, and I think both of these could be absolutely fascinating to play, is that they placed such an emphasis on the fact that Styles was alone with his mother when she died.
Yeah.
There was no one, there was, as far as we know, no one else there. If Claudia had been possessed at the time by the Nogitsune, could it have just, like, hopped on over to Styles?
Yeah.
I mean, to, like, save itself. Well, he was alone. It's potentially the way I was thinking is that, you know, Styles at that point would probably have been too young to have been able to sustain the Nogitsune at any kind of substantial power for it to be able to do anything.
Yeah.
Has the Nematon then unlocked it after they've performed the sacrifice?
I mean, I think the Nogitsune, the idea that you have of it jumping into Styles, I think that does tie in with the same thing of that it going into people who have this problem. Like, I think that one of those would sort of beget the other, if you know what I mean. Like, if it chose Claudia because it was masking, you know, it was sort of staying dormant and it was masking, either creating those symptoms that people are diagnosing as this medical thing or masking its presence by being in someone who really has this problem and then going on to the next best one when that died, which is Styles. But I don't know, and I just have a bad feeling about the entire situation, but it would be really interesting if we have managed to hit the nail on the head in terms of this diagnosis and stuff like that. And I'm just not glad, but I'm kind of glad that my sense about it being degenerative brain problem rather than, like, cancer was correct, because, you know, cancer's something that is obviously a huge problem, but it's not hereditary, you know, it's not contagious.
Cancer are. There's a subset of the Jewish population, the Ashkenazi Jews,
I'm Ashkenazi,
who have a very high prevalence for breast cancer, and there's actually genetic testing that can be done.
Oh, there is too. There's a few things that, like, we have problems with. I'm Ashkenazi Jew background.
Oh, okay.
And there's a few bloody problems that there's, like, there's something else that's a genetic, there's a whole bunch of tests that different, things, but it's not, you know, cancer is...
Yeah, it's not like if your mom has cancer, you're going to have cancer.
Yeah, there's
a prevalence of it.
And unless it is actually, you know, often obviously, you know, becomes brain related, which does happen with cancer, but... you know, it's unless it, that kind of thing happens and makes the person's behavior start to change, it's often seen as, like, sort of very portrayed in the media, you know, fairly or unfairly as very kind of brave and noble and coping and it's, you know, someone beautifully wilting away and whatever that kind of crap.
Yeah.
And it's, whereas, you know, a degenerative brain disease can lead to bad behavior from the patient, if you know what I mean. It can lead to it can lead to strange behavior. It can lead to awful things. And, you know, dealing with the idea of, like, someone really becoming a person you don't know anymore and all of that kind of thing. And I think that that is more potentially interesting to play in the context of this show, and also definitely more interesting in the concept of, like, Styles having any kind of mental disorder. Like, I think it fit really well, like, as opposed to, like, a sort of simple, sad death the way that cancer is made out to be in the media. Not that it's like that in real life. But, you know the stereotypical thing that I'm kind of talking about in chick lit books and stuff like that. Like, and so I think this is actually a lot more satisfying and interesting for the characters, potentially. And I'm kind of glad about it.
Yeah, the other thing that this made me think of is back in, so the first scene we got back from 3B, the scene where Styles wakes up and the sheriff is holding him is, and the first thought I had after seeing Claudia's symptoms were, did he do that for her as well?
Yeah. Yeah, I feel like that the sheriff is going to have a shit time this season, but
I'm making a grumpy cat face right now.
Yeah,
I figured you're probably not going to be the only one after this episode making grumpy cat faces at me. Probably your sister is also going to be right up there.
She will probably with you. Go through the internet.
Oh yeah. My gosh! Who wrote? I care more about the carpet being ruined than him
that
dying.
That would be mean.
Because I wrote. Did anyone cheer when he got stabbed? We'll get there. But yeah, do you want to go with the Scott motorbike slips the twins? Go ahead.
Yeah.
In the next scene, Scott slips his twin protectors and he takes Kira to his house in order to protect her from, the masked warriors. And this is basically when she tells him about the Kitsune myth and talks about foxfire, which she explains is sort of like what the Kitsune can do when they rub their tails together. They can make fire or lightning. And she talks about, you know, how that's sort of similar to what happened to her at the power station. And Jen and Danya, actually, both you guys are, you know, Japanese mythology gurus. Did you like the direction that they're going in with this? And did you think that it matches up with what we've, talked about in the past and the actual mythology that we've talked about before?
Yeah, from what I've read, it fits pretty well. I mean, they're taking some artistic liberties with it, I think.
You know, Kira clearly doesn't have too much of an idea, you know, how it's going to relate to her or what type she is. Like, they sort of go into there being different types. She kind of starts telling Scott about the Nogitsune at the same time that, you know, we'll talk about it in a second, the same time Allison and Isaac are finding out about it. But the Nogitsune, she kind of has all of these children's books and mythology books about it. You know, I wonder if she just had those lying around because she's a nerd, or whether she kind of went and researched specifically about, you know, what she might be. But I, with this scene, liked the, just sort of away from the Kitsune for a second, can we talk for 1 second about how Kira is definitely not a Gryffindor? Not that that's necessarily an insult, but she's the first person that's ever been like, if you didn't let the twins come here because you didn't want them to get hurt, if you don't want me to get hurt, shouldn't I be somewhere else? And she wasn't like a dick about it. She was very practical about it. She's like, but what are you doing?
I interpreted that it like completely differently, because she was basically saying like, if you didn't want people to get hurt, I wouldn't be here. There's another reason why we're here right now. Like, she knew that he thought that they were after her, and that's why he was with her, because she says, like, I don't want you to get hurt to protect me.
Well, I thought it was what she was saying sort of ended up with that at the end of the statement, but I more thought that it was like, whichever one it is, mm-hmm. we should be separated so that whichever one it is doesn't get hurt unnecessarily, if you know what I mean. I don't think she was being, like, selfish. I just think she was being practical.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like at the moment, I'm kind of going to call her a Slytherin, but not
I was thinking the same thing.
But not a douchebag Slytherin. Like, J.K. Rowling gives the Slytherins, I think, a lot more crap than they deserve because of the particular generation and Death Eaters and stuff that we're working with, but this school has existed for 1,000 years and there's, you know, hundreds of Slytherins that aren't Death Eaters, and I think that, you know, the biggest traits of that kind of culture, that kind of Slytherin identity is, you know, sort of practicality and not necessarily self-serving, because they're actually very loyal to the people that they care about themselves. Like, in the books, you'll see, like, that Slytherins are generally the ones that do things driven by, like, love for another person, like, very much. Like, you've got, like, Snape, Narcissa Malfoy, like, Merope Gaunt, all of those people did stuff that might be slightly crazy, but it's, like, driven out of, like, protectiveness for, like, individually loving someone rather than, like, the greater good or whatever, like Gryffindor. But this is going off tangent a bit. Anyway, I think that Kira is a Slytherin for her sort of practicality in the way that she wanted to handle the problem, whether it was Scott she was trying to protect or herself. I kind of found that interesting because I don't feel like anyone's ever responded like that to him before, like whether it was solely because she thought she was the one going to get him hurt or because she wasn't sure about who was going to get hurt. People don't usually go, like, running away from the protection of the werewolf. I don't think anyone's really reacted like that before. So that really stood out to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I can definitely see where, you know, all of that would come from.
Mm.
So Scott and Kira almost kiss, but they're interrupted by Agent McCall. And, yeah, we have a couple of different names for Agent McCall on this podcast. Jen apparently likes to call him Agent McAssface, which I think is very appropriate. I know Danya likes to call him Agent Blobfish, which is also very appropriate.
Oh, my God. You guys kill me. So he apparently found out that they were in his office because apparently his computer is set up to take a picture of whoever opens mm-hmm. it, which I suppose is if you're in the FBI, is like a thing that makes sense.
Genuine thing. There is actually a Mac security application that you can load onto your computer to actually do that.
So, like, mm-hmm. you check that
I've sold it.
So it's like if it's not you, every time it takes a picture of you, and then if it happens to not be you, you know that, uh-oh, someone's broken in.
Yeah, and it's also based, like, partially on location services. So when the Mac connects to Wi-Fi, it's not a trusted or known Wi-Fi location or isn't aware of where it is, it'll sometimes just snap a picture.
Oh, cool.
It's really fascinating security software. It's great.
Can people turn your webcam on from somewhere else and look at you?
Yeah.
Oh, that's really sad. Yeah.
If you are ever on your computer and the little light goes on, whether you have your webcam enabled or not, somebody has used third-party software to hack into your computer and turn it on. There's actually an underground group of people out there who do that. So it's why a lot of people who don't use their webcams will actually put tape over top of them.
Yeah.
I have a friend. So the same friend who I got the autographs for, his girlfriend, she does that on her laptop. She's got tape over her
webcam. I was going to say she does the hacking and spy on people.
No, she does the tape over the webcam thing.
Yeah. I think Selena does it as well. I think I've heard her talk about it. But
yeah, she's talked about that before.
But I have a non-Mac with a webcam that's detachable and not plugged in right now, so no one's going to get me, suckers! Sorry.
Oh, boy. Speaking of Agent McCall, though, basically the sun goes down and the masked warriors show up and, you know, they stab him. And first of all, I want to say that Wolfwatch says he died, which clearly he didn't die. Maybe he will die, you know, in the next episode, but he wasn't dead when they wheeled him into the hospital. So I now no longer trust their opinion on Barrow because they said he died. So, yeah, just throwing that out there. But the big thing here is, how did we actually feel about the possibility of McCall dying in this episode?
I literally do not care.
I was unfazed. I wrote down, did anyone cheer when he got stabbed? Jen wrote down, I care more about the carpet being ruined than him dying. So, I mean, it would be, you know, it would be interesting to have him die with, like, everything really unfinished with Scott, if you know what I mean? Because mm-hmm. Melissa clearly, you know, tries to help him and is all like, you know, oh, he's like, I need to talk to Scott. You know why I really came back? To be a good father. And, you know, well, he doesn't say that, but we assume that's what he means or whatever. We are like, no. Very profound, I know. I think it would have been really interesting to have him died completely unresolved and to see whether Scott cares or not, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. I think that's a really interesting way to look at it. And, like, it would be quite different to have it because, you know, everybody always says, like, on their dying breath, like, oh, I loved you all along or something like that, yeah. You know? So I think to make it go unresolved would be really interesting. But at the same time, I actually really didn't want him to die. I mean, I don't like the guy. I think he's a jerk. I think that even in this episode, he was being
the way he went into the station, the police station, and talking on the phone. It's like laughing at the idea of he's still trying to get like the sheriff fired. Like,
I totally agree with that. But at the same time, I think that like it was kind of shocking, and I really didn't want him to die with Scott being so resentful toward him, like, even, or to, like, not know the secret of why McCall is there. I think, like, that is important to kind of resolve some things for Scott.
Imagine if he died, and literally the last thing Scott said to him was, like, that you're just a gene donor who gave me my hair color. Like,
yeah.
Like, imagine, I was kind of like, is that what's happened? Oh my god, this is so harsh. Like, when I didn't know he was going to survive at the end, when I first watched the episode, I was like, wow, this is, like, way harsh. But Melissa's clearly not here for that in terms of she's like, no, you don't just get to say that to him on your dying breath. You have to say that to him like a real person who's alive. Like, you can't just have it be this deathbed confession. So she seems pretty pissed about that. So I kind of liked that, like... Do you think what he has to say to Scott is that, like, I loved you all along, Sonny boy, or, like, that he has something secret that he needs to tell him, like, the family secret?
I think he has another family, and I think that's, like, who he was talking to on the phone. Because, I mean, I don't think that it would just be like, oh, I've loved you all along. Like, clearly he cares about Scott. Mm-hmm. I mean, he does call him, like, you know, his son and stuff like that. So I think that it's got to be something a little bit bigger than just that.
Oh, I don't know. Why would he want to tell him that on his dying breath? Like,
go I don't and know.
Love your mother, brother. Maybe
it's the secret that Styles knows.
Yeah, that's what I assume. But I kind of wonder if, like, yeah, he's got a half-brother or something, and it's, like, important that he knows that. Because if I had, you know, a long-lost sibling, that would kind of rock my world. I mean... Maybe in a good way, maybe in a bad way, but I would definitely want to know about it.
Yeah, I know someone who found out about, like, a long-lost sibling, like, when they were an adult, and it was very confusing and weird for them, so, yeah.
Yeah, I can't even imagine.
But, yeah, while he's bleeding out on the floor, the twins...
Ruining, like, the carpet.
The twins, like, God, so inconsiderate, Agent McArsface. the twins bust through the window, which... I was like, they just spent a long time closing all the windows, so is that an open bit of glass going to, like, be a problem for you now? Like, I was a bit confused. I mean, I know Melissa's security system kind of goes beyond glass, but I was like, they just closed everything, and now you've put a big hole in the wall. and then Derek sock slides through the door, and then, which is fun. So, yeah, do you want to talk about that?
Okay, look, seriously, I am 1,000% here for Derek Hale right now. Yes. As a beta, like, I know a lot of people are like, he's not an alpha anymore, and he's going to be like Scott's beta, and it's so weird, and I totally get that, But no, okay, because he is so not on his power trip anymore. He's not on his alpha juice. He's not going to have any of those issues that he did before. And he is like, look, you might kill for Scott McCall, but I would die for Scott McCall. And it just, it gives me so many feelings.
Yeah.
And I love how, like, all the issues right now that they've gone through are gone. Like, he is just like, okay, listen to Scott. Like, if Scott says do nothing while the Oni are attacking them, then we're gonna do nothing.
Here's the thing, and I think I've just managed to sort of pin this down in my brain. I love Derek being superior to people, but not as an alpha, if you know what I mean. Like, it's too much alpha juice when he's an alpha. I think that he can still be superior to Scott in a lot of ways in terms of being a human being who's older and more educated and, you know, more experienced, and he can share that with Scott and help him and stuff like that, but he's not a leader, if you know what I mean. But I like him, like, cutting down, like I want him to be Scott's proper, like, right-hand Beta, like his, like, the Hermione to his Harry, if you know what I mean. I know Styles is kind of the Hermione, but, like, I also want Derek to be the werewolf Hermione, you know, like, and, like, he's technically, you know, quote unquote, like, you know, he might be like smarter or more powerful or whatever, like physically stronger, I don't care, but, like, he's not the leader, and he does trust Scott, and he, you know, and I want him to basically smack down everyone on Scott's behalf and be super superior to everyone on Scott's behalf, because Scott won't be super superior to everyone. And I want him to sneer at people, and it's great. So, yeah, the way that he kind of comes in and Scott's like, why are you here? And he's like, I was following you. Like, duh. Yeah. You know, that's what I do. I creep on teenagers.
Oh, president of the Scott McCall fan club. He's got the badge and everything.
And it's like, Scott's like, how long? And he's like, all day. And even the Teen Wolf, official Teen Wolf, like, reblogged gif sets of that with a gif from Up of the talking dog being like, shutting up watch because I love you. And I'm like, so we know the show's opinion on this, I guess.
And the other thing about Derek in this scene that I kind of was like, does that count as him winning a battle?
I think it does.
Like, when he pushes the Oni out of the door, he actually doesn't end up getting thrown through a wall or anything. And
congratulations!
Does that count?
Tail.
It only took 3.5 seasons.
The win 2.5 column?
I think we can. Let's do it for Derek Hale.
Yeah, he's got to take his wins when he gets them. So he's fun, and I really liked that scene where he talks to the twins, where they're like, they're like, we're going to be Scott's Betas. We will fight for Scott. We will, you know, and he's like, I'm sure you will. I'm sure you'd kill for Scott. Yeah, but would you die for him? Because I would!
Oh my god, I love it so much.
Fantastic. He is becoming the best he could possibly be, and I think that's
phenomenal.
It's just so good. I love him so much. I just have no time for people that don't like Derek. I follow someone on Tumblr who's completely, I don't even follow them because of Teen Wolf, but they apparently like Teen Wolf, and they were saying all of this stuff about the characters they liked, and he's like, I don't care about Derek. I'm not here for Derek. I'm here for the teenagers being friends. And I'm like, oh, but Derek, he never, but no. And I was very upset. This person I don't even know, who I don't even follow because of Teen Wolf, apparently doesn't like Derek. I was very sad. But I love him. He's fantastic.
Danny knows how I feel about Derek.
There are a lot of feelings about Derek, you know.
Oh, my God.
Any and all fire jokes that may ever be said, put aside, I do love Derek a lot.
Yeah, I think Karen too. Yesterday when we were talking about this, it's not going to be funny anymore.
You're going to call me out on this?
You are so good!
Do it. Call her out.
Okay. Derek, well, it's definitely...
episode.
It's not going to be funny, but yesterday, on accident, complete accident, it just slipped out, and I said that Derek was on fire this episode because he was so good and amazing, and I just instantly regretted it. I can't believe I said that.
It was so Karen. See, we're not losing any content from re-recording this episode, but we're losing so many of the like impromptu jokes and reactions. Sorry guys, but yeah, you missed a really funny joke where Karen accidentally Derek was on fire. Sorry.
I blushed. Like I was Danya blushing because I was like, I can't believe I just said that.
I'm a level of blushing.
You are the top level.
And he seriously is constantly like staring at me from our little poster that we got, like from my desk shelf right above my head on my eye level, glaring, saying so many fire jokes. So it was just amazing. But then we find out basically as well, moving swiftly away from fire jokes, that a great line, basically, Deaton, you know, they come home, they're, you know, fixing up all the windows, closing everything up, and I think slightly before the twins get there, Scott's, we've got this new security system, stuff happened a couple of weeks ago, my boss helped us put in the security system, and Kieran's like, do you work for a security company? And he's like, no, he's a veterinarian. He didn't even say it like, yeah, I know, I have to explain this. He was like, no, like, and then we find out that it was basically, he can't arm it, only Melissa can because, you know, she's a human. They basically do a mountain ash barricade. They put ash floorboards, I think, across the all the door and had window frames and activate it with live mountain ash, I guess, and, you know, it puts up the barricade around the whole house, which very much reminded me of the whole, like, what happens to the vampires in Buffy when they haven't been specifically invited in and how they can do like an uninviting ceremony, like totally different thing, but similar result in that it's like a zappy barrier for the supernatural. So Melissa comes home and activates that and then like saves McCall, Agent McCall, from like bleeding out on the carpet, who I guess if he's alive definitely knows something's going on because he got stabbed by a smoke demon. So
yeah, like he's gonna have questions when he wakes up.
Yeah,
so many questions. I am mildly suspicious about the security system.
Yeah.
Why now? Why now? Why put it in now? Why not when the Alpha Pack was around? Why not?
Maybe they didn't realize they could do it, or maybe Deaton is just like the most unhelpful person in the world.
But this is, I have so many thoughts about Deaton and his supposed
help
neutral status that he's got. That I've always thought there's something not quite right.
No,
there.
It's the way he talks. He talks like he's like, he's being as unhelpful as possible, I feel like, often. Like, he's doing the minimal to look like he's on the right side while actually being super unhelpful. And we haven't seen him this season, so who knows. But
we saw him in the first episode back.
Yeah, I was gonna say, we did see him for a brief moment.
Oh, yeah?
To basically tell them that they have a door open in their minds and they don't know how to fix it, so...
Oh, that was really helpful. Yeah. So
it had a weakness. It had like a really massively glaring weakness.
Oh, where he was able to push through. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I want to know why they didn't just bust through a wall. Because like, they had the doors and the windows barricaded with the ash, but the walls weren't.
Well, I don't know.
I think it forms a circle, though.
Yeah, I feel like it sort of, if it's done with the mountain ash, that it might just do the whole house. But I don't know. It's, I mean, the weakness, obviously they'd never seen those demons before, and that you don't know whether they're, like, different, if it works for werewolves specifically, you know, and it, you know, other supernatural creatures might have different levels of power, or, like, maybe they're less supernatural and more natural. I don't know. But yeah, Deaton, I'm
watching you, Deaton.
My jury is always out on Deaton because I feel like he is like the least helpful person ever. So, you know, that's always, you're either massively incompetent or you're not actually trying to help. So, yeah.
Playing a game that we can't quite see yet.
Yeah.
Right. Kind of like Morel. I guess that would make sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're both shifty.
Yeah. So, hey, Danya.
Hey.
We saw Shang Tsung this episode. You and I are going to be the only ones excited for this.
Because we've been going on about this, obviously, outside of this podcast. This has been going on for months.
Yes, it has. Katashi, Mr. Katashi, who Chris and Allison finally find, and Allison does a cool... It's cool. Before we get into the Mortal Kombat thing, because I have some words about that... They find Katashi and they get him to sit down and talk. And Chris and Allison is like an equal team. Like, Allison, take the man's gun. Super cool.
Oh my gosh. She looks like, so awesome doing that.
They're partners. It was so cool. But anyway, Mortal Kombat. Okay, Katashi is played by some guy that I can't remember his name.
Hiroyuki Tagawa.
Thank you. He plays Shang Tsung, the evil bad guy, in the 1995 seminal classic Mortal Kombat based on the video game, in which Lyndon Ashby, our good friend Sheriff Stilinski, plays Johnny Cage. I watched this the other day because Karen made me. It's real bad. It's real bad. It's so bad. I have some really important questions about this movie, okay? Number one, why is the main guy, Lee or Liu, whatever his name is his grandfather a monk? Because monks don't have children. Like, he's the grandfather, but he's also a monk. And I'm like, I don't understand how that works. I don't understand how they live in, like, a normal world where there's, like, Hollywood and, like, bad movies and stuff. And, like, yet they, like, it's just fine that this, like, apparent ultimate dimension exists, and like sometimes people go off and fight in it to stop the world being evil. It's not like a totally supernatural AU. It's like the normal world, but like where everyone knows that this is a thing, as opposed to like something like Supernatural or Teen Wolf, where like that's like secret. And I don't understand why they just go off to play like the Hunger Games once a generation or whatever, and it's just real bad. And I don't understand why, like, they were fine showing Mr. Katashi, like, smashing and breaking the back of a small child in the opening scene of the movie, which was super disturbing. And I was like, I don't think they'd show that in television now. Like, I don't know. This and the music is really, it's like joke level of bad. And it's, and all the movement, like, there was a bit where, like, some demons came in and they were like, we've got company, and it was like from two different exits. It literally looked like a spoof. Like, it looked like a joke. It's so bad. It's
you are punching my childhood in the face right now, Natalie.
I'm really
come on.
Sure, I liked lots of bad movies, but my god. Lyndon was very funny. He was,
yes,
he escalated it. Like, he like his delivery, but the way he looked was like so 90s and gross, and it was like like his fluffy hair, and it was like he looked better in the video game. Like, I remember the characters from the video game like existing, and I just don't think the concept of the video game is strong enough to sustain an actual movie. It's so bad. But I found out it was directed by, I think, Paul W.S. Anderson or something, whatever his name is, who I then found out, like, well, when I looked at the list of films he directed, also directed literally my most hated movie of all time, which is the Three Musketeers adaptation that came out a few years ago with Orlando Bloom. Oh, my God. It's so bad. I wanted to leave the cinema. I love kind of that kind of era of thing. I love like other movies about the Three Musketeers or all of that kind of, you know, 17th century, you know, Britain and France conflict. Yeah, this ended up with frickin' airships, like dirigibles, blimps. Like, it went all steampunk at the end, and Logan Lerman played D'Artagnan, which is not a thing. And it was so bad. I literally wanted to leave the cinema. I thought the movie was going to be so good because, oh my god, new Three Musketeers adaptation. It was so bad and ridiculous. And it was just, apparently this guy only makes terrible movies. So
Danya, Shang Tsung.
Sorry.
We'll be excited.
It was really cool though. Like, I mean, it was really different seeing him do this because obviously he's a lot older now. He doesn't have like his long black hair, but he also wasn't like, evil. Like, I was actually, you know, even from all the promotional stuff that we saw, I thought he was going to be a bad guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the end, he says, you know, I owe you more than my life. I owe you my honor. And I was like, wow, that's not the direction I thought they were going to go in. But I really liked it. And I thought, you know, even though he had a fairly small role, his performance was really good. And it was just kind of exciting. I'm just kind of sad that, you know, him and Johnny Cage couldn't have been in some scenes together.
Well, I was like, do you think he came down and, like, saw him or whatever? Like,
I hope so.
I hope they were hanging out on set.
Yeah.
I hope there's photographic evidence somewhere of it. And it needs to see the light of day somehow, because if there is not a photo of the two of them together, I will probably cry.
Oh, well. No one tells me that there's not. So, I mean, he basically has his own protection team. I do like the bit where the guy brings in Isaac and he's like, they have a werewolf too. Like, it was kind of like, I did find that amusing. But, yeah, he chills out pretty quickly when he finds out who Chris is and how basically he was actually not planning to fight the Warriors. He was planning to run away, and that Chris shooting the guy gave him a moment to kind of redeem himself and get away without it looking like he was being a gross coward. And apparently if that had happened, they would have chopped off his head. So he owes Chris all of this stuff and tells him what he's found out so far about the Warriors, which are called the Oni.
Yeah, and Jen, you had a little bit of note in here, I think it was from you, about the Oni and how it's more of like a generic term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Oni just means demon. It doesn't reference anything specifically. Generally, when you're looking at folk tales, if they want to talk about like a specific demon, they either have a name that may or may not have Oni as part of it. Or there's a specific location where they're like, okay, this is the Oni in Tono, you know, or the Oni in Tokyo, or the Oni in Kyoto, where it's a specific location referring to it. But otherwise, it's just kind of a generic term for demon.
Okay, that's interesting. And basically, the Oni are marking everybody to make sure that they're still themselves. And they're looking for the Nogetsune, which is the void, the sort of like the evil Kitsune, I guess, is how we're going to refer to it here. And, you know, that's the dark spirit that they're going to be looking for. But what I thought was interesting here too was that there are 13 different kinds of kitsune, and my first thought is, okay, so what are our guesses for what kind Kira is?
I have a breakdown of all the different ones. I don't know. Is the 13 kinds like a, did the show just make that up, or is that just a random
number?
There
are different kinds of kitsune. The ones that I remember off the top of my head were celestial.
Yeah. And then like sky. Water, earth.
Yeah.
We touched on it slightly in the kitsune mythology episode.
Yeah.
Do you think we have enough information to guess which one she is? Because I was thinking about, like, because I think they mentioned, like, Thunder 2 or something like that, and I didn't know if the Foxfire was something that all kitsunes can do, like, if all of them have that power over, like, electricity and fire, or if maybe, like, that could kind of determine, or at least narrow down what type she could be.
Yeah, she's definitely not a kitsune, but that's about as far as I've... Really, what I want to see is the kanji that appears on her neck, because we were able to see the one on Scott's, and it was that same one meaning self. But I think if we're able to see the one that appears on Kira, it's going to give us an idea of what type of kitsune she is.
Really? Well, but wouldn't they still mark her as, like, being herself?
Maybe. I mean, it's just a thought that it might be, since they're out hunting a Nogitsune, which is a specific type of kitsune, that they might identify her either as kitsune, like maybe it'll be the kanji for kitsune, or maybe it will, you know, just be self or something. But I really want to see what's on Kira's neck.
That's interesting. I didn't even think about that. But speaking of the Oni too, do we think that the Nemeton has actually like sent them to Beacon Hills to protect against this Nogitsune? Because I mean, the fireflies and the smoke came out of the Nemeton and formed, and now we know that they're the Oni. And so it kind of just makes me wonder if, you know, we were talking yesterday about, we don't really know if they're good or bad or neutral, or if they kind of just have this like whole balance thing going on. But
because it's not like they're technically, they are after something that is bad or harmful to the world. And they're very, you know, ruthless about people sort of stopping them from checking if they're bad or whatever. But they're not actually, you know, harming it. Like what he said, the people just have to endure the check. And if they're not the Nogitsune, then they're not evil and that they're just left alone. You know, I just don't think they... I think that they're just possibly a force that exists in the in the universe. And yeah, I don't know. It's very confusing to me because originally we did think that they were really bad, if you know what I mean, if they were that they were really evil. And...
yeah, I mean, they certainly aren't good... but I don't think they're like, I don't think they're evil. They're somewhere in between.
Not in the traditional sense of being evil in that they're out for everyone, the way that most of the big bads in Teen Wolf have been. You know, that they've either had like a specific subset of people that they've been after for revenge purposes, usually. Mm-hmm. But they're not specifically out for, like, a group of people. They're specifically out for this one type of kitsune who is, as we've been told, complete evil. Like, it's void, it's chaos. And, you know, we get that line from Katashi saying, if you find it, you destroy it, even if it's your own daughter. And I think that really sets up the whole... what this Nogitsune is capable of, the strife, the chaos and everything that it could cause. So I think it's very difficult to categorize it. It's made it very much not black and white. The bad guy in this season it's not very cut and dry, because you've got so many different facets to it that these Oni we've been led to believe are evil. Well, it's not. They are and they aren't. So it's so fascinating the way that they're taking this season. I'm really into it. I'm so into it this season.
I want to say it's almost like Dementors. Not that I think Dementors aren't evil, but they're not malevolent, if you know what I mean. They just are what they are. They do what they do. They're not like really doing it by like choice or like they're sort of just directed to do what they do, and that's what they do. Like, it's not, you know.
I think that's a really good comparison, and I think that makes what Scott did even braver, because he basically, well, first of all, Allison tells him, don't do anything, they're just going to check you and it's going to be fine. He put a lot of trust in Allison, not that he has any reason not to. I mean, obviously she's not going to set him up in a situation where he's going to die, but I think that just kind of shows, you know, the type of trust and bond that they have. And then secondly, he tells everyone to do nothing, and he and Kira go up to the Oni to get checked and everything is fine, but the amount of trust everybody else has in him, particularly Derek, who is technically an older and wiser werewolf who's been in this world a heck of a lot longer than Scott. I think it's amazing that he kind of defers to Scott in that moment and just lets him call the shot. And especially when Aiden tries to move forward to like attack the Oni or save Scott or something, Derek holds him back because he knows that Scott made this choice and he's going to honor it. And it's just, I just love seeing that from Scott and from Derek.
Yeah.
Okay. So going into, wait, hold on a second.
The last scene?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we covered pretty much everything.
Yeah.
All right. So going into the last scene here, basically Scott and Melissa take Agent McCall to the hospital and they kind of send him off on his way. Scott says he's going to go look for Stiles. And before he gets there, we see Stiles, and basically he's the one that is possessed with the Nogitsune, and he takes out the Oni that finds him, and we get a little bit of evil Stiles. And
it's amazing.
It is so amazing. But wow. You know what? It's kind of strange because it's not that I didn't see this coming. I mean, I had a feeling that once we figured out what exactly the Oni were after. So, and like pretty much the whole episode, I knew that it was going to end with finding out that something was seriously wrong with Stiles. So it's not like it took me by surprise, but just the acting and just the fact that, now we know what is going on with Stiles was just... I don't even have words, which is not good when you're on a podcast, but I'll let you guys talk about it because I'm just kind of like speechless.
That split second between him standing there with his back to Scott and Scott asking like if he's fine, if he's okay. And you see his face and then he just turns around and that split second of, yeah, I'm fine, what's up? That was phenomenal. I was so impressed with just that. It was just like 2 seconds. 2 seconds, and he turned around, and it was like, those were two completely different people. And that, I thought that was amazing. I thought that was great.
Dylan's phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, it was really, just that sort of coldness when he was clearly being possessed or reacting was... Yeah, like you said, you kind of knew that that's what we were going to end up seeing, but until you properly saw it, it was kind of hard to imagine how well he could do it, like how well he could do a dark role. I mean, people have wanted dark Stiles for ages. It's like such a favorite idea in the fandom. But I will say that I still think that in the last episode, in the moment when he's sitting in the car outside the station and waiting for them and spinning the keys on his finger, if you go back and look at that, I swear it's the same look. I swear that was meant to be a moment that he was possessed. Like, go and look at him in that moment, like, look at his face. It's really mechanical. Like, it's in the same way that when we finally see him possessed, and I swear it's meant to be a moment that was happening to him. But... Oh, it was so badass. It was like, oh my God, though.
And it's funny because a lot of people take like a villainous role or even like a dark role, like not necessarily being a villain, and they do it really over the top, and you can tell by, you know, a lot of different ways, like exactly what's going on. Like, he literally just uses his eyes. Like, there's not even really any facial movements or anything like that. It's all in his eyes. And for him to switch that on and off like that is just something that I don't think everybody can do. And it was just, it made it even creepier.
And I mean, when he turned around and switched off, I mean, like, how much consciousness do you think he has of what's going on? Like, do you think it's literally like he doesn't know that he's blacked out, like he isn't aware that he's blacked out and he's like, yeah, I'm fine, like, what's up? Or do you think that was him pretending to be okay, or like, or what? Like,
I think that was genuine, and I think maybe he just like was like, okay, I'm in this hospital and I don't necessarily know what happened for this like entire minute, but it's not something that really is noticeable
to
him.
I
think that it really was him when he turned around and was like, yeah, I'm fine, what's up?
I thought he was the best.
I honestly wondered. I thought both, so I'm halfway
it's
between.
Hard to tell.
Yeah
the other hint I think we've gotten, like, thinking back on it, the other hint that we may have maybe overlooked at one point, because when he's talking to Agent McCall, when he's stalling for Scott and Kira, the bit where he goes, I know your secret. That was very sinister. It was very dark, even for Stiles. But
I don't know. I took that one as like just how cold and dark he can be as a person. Like, I don't know if it's, you know, these feelings are coming out stronger because of this thing, but I took that as like an implication of how ruthless he is, like, regardless of possession. And I don't know, it's, I have to go back and rewatch everything, though. It's really stressful.
Yeah, I'm going to be rewatching everything.
So does anyone have any final thoughts of this episode before we finish up?
I just need more of it. It needs to be Wednesday or Monday again.
You're like, I need to know everything now.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Pretty much.
So we're going to finish up now with our non sequitur question quickly, seeing as there's four of us. But I've picked a question today, which is, should be easy enough to answer. Basically, what is the weirdest / coolest thing that you can touch right now, like, on that you can reach out and or see, at least see, if you're in a, you know, if you're in the middle of your bed with all you can touch is pillows, like, what is the coolest thing in your nearest vicinity or weirdest thing in your nearest vicinity?
I guess coolest thing is I haven't put my Christmas decorations away, and you can all make all the faces at me if you want, but I've got a little desk, and on my desk my Lego bauble is still there, and it's got, it's basically, it's clear, it's on the top, it's got like a little white snowflakes on the top, and it's got a yellow ribbon tied on it, and it's got gold and yellow Lego pieces in it. And it's like my favorite thing. I love it. I saw it in the Lego store, because I work near a Lego store, and I have a real problem walking past that store and not buying something every single time. And at Christmas, because they always have the red and green ones, I've never ever seen them have the yellow ones in stock whenever I've walked past. So I basically just, it was, I was walking out with it in my hand, like, having paid for it before I'd even realized that I'd gone into the Lego store to buy it from having seen it. Yeah.
You're gonna have to send me a picture of this, because I literally can't imagine what the thing looks like. Like, but yeah.
Post it on Tumblr or Twitter.
Yeah.
I'll put it up on my Twitter. I'll snap a picture of it. I'll put it up on my Twitter, and I'll tag you in. It's cool. Yeah.
Jen, what about you?
Well, I can see stuff on my bookshelf. So there's two things that are kind of cool. One is a box filled with Christmas cards that my students made me when I left Japan.
Aww.
So that's kind of fun. And then I've got my chainmail stuff up here too, because I do chainmail in my spare time.
That is so cool.
Yeah, I was going to say, in that case, I'll say mine is a bow and arrow, like a full size. I have a full size bow and a quiver of arrows resting on my desk right now.
That's awesome.
It's pretty old. Like, it's a real sports bow, but not like an adult Allison sized one. It's one I had as a teenager, like more of a one, like a, it's not like a toy one from a shop. If you not from a toy shop, it's a bow. It's not a super advanced bow, but it's, you know, I've had it since I was about 12 or 13, because medieval nerd. And it doesn't usually live directly on my desk, but I just switch bedrooms, and so that's where it is right now.
Karen, what do you got?
Okay, this is oddly appropriate, actually, but this, I'm so bad at the non sequitur. No, this actually sits on my bookshelf. I've got a signed copy of Carmen's CD, and they were on Wolf Watch after this episode, so that was kind of cool. And it's their Hello EP, and I saw them in concert at this thing that we call the Speedy Fest around where I live, and I got them both Amy and Nick to sign the pamphlet inside the CD, and I got to tell them that they're amazing and they were super nice about it, and I really love Carmen, because I've known them on YouTube for a while, and this was right when they were starting to blow up with Broken Hearted, so it was cool to kind of like be one of the people that has known them for a while and kind of saw their growth and everything.
And now there's celebrity guests on Wolf Watch.
Yeah! Oh, I was so excited!
Well, you can check out Karen's favorite band that she spams Hyperball with articles about, like, when she doesn't like any other music articles except Eminem.
Shut up! Okay. okay.
I think I've edited one of them.
It's fine. It's hilarious. But it's like, yeah, not
them and Carmen, and I don't write any other music, but nobody else will cover it. And so I'm just like, Pam, I'm doing this stuff on these guys. And she's like,
God, imagine if I started covering One Direction news on high school. Like, full on as a fandom. I couldn't do it, like, because it's too dramatic and their fandom is too crazy. We report when they release new videos and stuff, but, like, I couldn't do, like, the way that, like, Sugarscape does, like, every move they make as a news article. Like, oh my God, I'd die. But Karen, yeah, is not a music writer, but she covers Eminem and Carmen because she wants to promote them, and it's hilarious and cute. maybe you can invite them to BiteCon. Karen's like crying.
Don't even joke. Okay.
We should finish up now. So the next episode is called Riddled, to air next week, and hopefully we'll see Lydia back again, and maybe Peter, we don't know, but Styles goes missing, and I guess that is what we have for this week. So I'll see you all next week.
Bye. Guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Can't believe Harry Styles has been missing for 9 days, by the way. What? Just saying, not missing in a police, like, being reported missing way, but, like,
okay,
it's the longest he's gone under the radar without anyone, like, knowing where he is or seeing him for, like, 9 days. And that's a lot when you're Harry Styles.
Is he still away, or is he back in the UK yet?
This is the thing. No one fucking knows.
Maybe he's stuck in London traffic. not kidding, because the tube went on strike today. Yeah, so, like,
no, I'd believe it. But yeah, no one knows whether he came home and is hiding out with his parents and hasn't been seen, or if he's like in some like complex in LA recording a fucking solo album and hadn't been ordering pizza. Or, like, whatever. It was his birthday, and usually they have, like, a very public birthday party for him. Nothing. Like, he's literally radio silence, hasn't tweeted. He is completely hidden, and I do not know where. I mean, good for him if that's what he wants, but I'm, you know, worried he's dead in a ditch somewhere. So,
are you sure he's not dead? That's terrifying.
Yeah, I'm kind of weirded out. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like,
Slightly impressed.
If it was someone less famous, I'd be like, oh yeah, sometimes you don't know where they are or whatever, or they tweet or whatever. He is never not seen for this long, and it's really not necessarily by paparazzi, but by like fans. Like, people will be like, oh my God, I just met Harry on the street, fan photo or whatever, and someone will find it and be able to stalk him. I can't believe he's avoided it for this long. Maybe he's gone off to some like small town in Montana where no one knows One Direction or something, and he's become a farmer. I don't know.